Now Smithy was going to do something to try to shake it off.
Okay, Smithy, I told him, I'll be expecting you at 12 noon and I'll do exactly as you say. I went back to the hotel. I didn't even recall whether Dahl and his secretary dropped me off or whether Captain Smith dropped me off en route to wherever he was going. Brother, I didn't like him leaving me. I'd had enough mystery. When he refused to tell me where he was going, it sent cold chills up and down my backbone. I carried out his orders. I went up to my hotel room and locked the doors. I watched my wristwatch like a hawk and I checked my time with the telephone company several times. I walked around for a while like a caged lion but spent most of my time gazing out of the windows. 12 o'clock, and no Captain Smith. 12:30 came, and no Smithy. 1 o'clock, and still no Smithy. I was really getting worried. It wasn't until nearly 2 o'clock that I heard a knock on my hotel room door. I was nearly frantic. I felt heavily the responsibility of starting this investigation and getting all these nice people involved in it. Was I glad to see Captain Smith when I opened the door? With him was a military man. Captain Smith quickly introduced him to me as Major Sander of S2 Army Intelligence of McCord Field. Captain Smith said, "I'll tell you, Ken, where I went and what I did." What a relief that was. At last I was going to hear something. That didn't account for my elation. I was elated because I was so doggone glad to see Smithy. Smithy started talking. I phoned McCord Field from the cafe. I told Major Sander I wanted to see him. I drove out to the base. I didn't tell you where I was or whom I was going to see for the simple reason that I wanted to tell my story separately from yours and unknown to you. Then Major Sander could compare my interpretation of everything that has happened with yours independently of each other. I said, "That's swell, Smithy. Boy, am I glad to see you." Major Sander was a middle-aged man about 5 feet 11 inches tall. He had a pleasant smile and blue eyes and spoke in the softest voice I think I have ever heard a major use. He took a chair over by the window. I went over and half reclined on the bed and started telling him everything I knew that had taken place. I don't think I left out a thing. Captain Smith said nothing. After I had finished, Captain Smith made the remark to Major Sander, "You see, all this must have happened because our stories are the same," or something to that effect. Major Sander made the quiet remark that he was positive that Smith and I had been made the victims of a hoax. Of course, it hadn't been completely evaluated yet. It was something that would take a couple of weeks to come to a positive decision about. He asked us not to discuss the matter any further with anyone and told us that in approximately 2 weeks, through his office or thought the office of A2 Military Intelligence of the 4th Air Force, an explanation would be forthcoming to each of us privately. I remember thinking, well, in 2 weeks I'll know what in the dickens happened in Tacoma. Major Sander had such a quiet, positive, reassuring way about him that at that particular moment all of the things about Chrisman and Dahl that didn't ring true suddenly came to our minds. At least, they did to mine and from. The shrug of Captain Smith's shoulders, I was certain the same things were going through his mind. "I am very certain," Major Sander continued, "that the B-25 crash was just another one of those accidents. It's too bad that a misleading story was printed in the newspaper." Right there I looked at Captain Smith. We knew that the story, if it was misleading, was so from only one standpoint, that no definite proof had been established regarding the possible sabotage of the B-25. We let his remark go. We were so blamed happy. At least we felt free to leave Tacoma and go home. Major Sander got up from his chair and made some remark about the fragments on the floor. He nonchalantly started picking up a few. I remember him saying that they would have these analyzed for the sake of being through, but that he wanted us to take a drive with him. He was going to show us thousands of tons of this stuff. Apparently these supposed fragments from a flying disc were really something else. We brightened up. We were going to be shown and that made us happy. Major Sander started gathering up and wrapping the fragments in a hotel towel with the intention of taking them with him. There were lots of fragments on the floor and all around, and both Smithy and I started helping him pick them up. I ran into a piece that looked like it would make a good ashtray. Almost at the same time, Smithy ran into another piece that he put in his pocket, saying it would make a good paperweight. I said, "Yeah, I think I'll take a piece of this home, too, for an ashtray. I'll remind me of the screwiest adventure I ever had." Major Sander had gathered up all the pieces and piloted them on top of several towels. He started to bundle them up, stopped short, turned to me and said, "We don't want to overlook even one piece. I would like to have them all." That gave me a start. I handed him my piece and Captain Smith's eyes met mine over Major Sander's back. The Major put out his hand to Captain Smith for his piece. He, like myself, willingly gave it to him. Maybe Major Sander was not conscious of what Captain Smith and I mentally said to one another. I thought, this Major Sander is a pretty smooth guy, but he's not smooth enough at this point to convince me that these fragments aren't pretty important in some way. I suddenly felt that no one had played a hoax on anybody. I thought, Major Sander is a phony dressed up in a lot of sheer intelligence as to how psychologically to handle men. I had bumped into a few of these fellow in my life. From the things they say, it is pretty tough to decipher what they really mean. These thoughts ran through my mind in spite of my very real desire to come to a definite conclusion about this whole affair. Major Sander proceeded to wrap everything up in the bundle. I offered to help carry it downstairs and he insisted on doing that himself. When we reached the south entrance of the hotel lobby, Major Sander opened the trunk of his car and placed the wrapped fragments in the trunk. It was a civilian car. I remember making the remark that we shouldn't steal the hotel towels as they would certainly bill me for them. We were short of towels in the room anyhow. Major Sander motioned for Captain Smith and me to get in his car. He was going to take us out and how us something. He didn't tell us where he was going to take us, but by this time we didn't much care. We drove clear out on the point of the peninsula. Soon we arrived at a large sign that read Tacoma Smelting Company or something like that. He drove along the road into those grounds. There were literally piles of lava-like smelter slag. At first glance it looked identical to the fragments Major Sander had taken from our room and loaded into the trunk of his car. All of the sudden I thought, well, I'll be darned. I guess Major Sander is right. Someone has played a hoax on us. At that moment we wanted to believe so. If Major Sander had not stopped the car and invited us to get out and look at the smelter slag, we would have left Tacoma happy that we had been fooled. He drove down a little side road among the piles of slag, stopped the car, and we all got out. Captain Smith and I started picking up pieces and inspecting them. It looked a lot like the box of fragments we had been handling in our room for the past 3 days. We had handled them, weighed them, looked at them and felt the touch of them in our hands. When we picked up pieces of slag and held them in our hands, we kind of looked at each other. I don't know what Smithy was thinking. I thought, yes, it looks like the same stuff, it's heavy like the same stuff, but it doesn't feel like the same thing. The smelter slag that I picked up looked more like the box of supposed fragments that Fred Crisman had given Captain Davidson and Lieutenant Brown. I remembered feeling one of the pieces as Crisman and Davidson were transferring that heavy box from Crisman's car to the trunk of the command car. I can't very well explain or demonstrate the difference in the feel of things such as this. To give you an idea as to how I evaluated this in my mind, close your eyes and have someone hand you a rock, a piece of brass, a piece of steel, a piece of aluminium, and a piece of copper. If you try this, as I have many times, you will notice that each one of these items has a particular feel to your fingers. It is something that your memory of feeling retains. Neither Smithy nor I bothered to take any samples of the smelter slag. Major Sander didn't offer us any of our own fragments from the trunk of his car so we could compare them with the smelter slag. I believe both of us thought of this. Major Sander, however, had seemed a little touchy about letting us get our hands on the fragments again after he wrapped them up. Neither of us said anything about it. At this point, if there is such a thing as hypnosis or hallucination that could have affected us in this evaluation, we would certainly have been affected to believe conclusively that all the fragments were smelter slag from this very smelter. This dump was handy to town. The stories of Chrisman and Dahl did not ring complete true. And Captain Smith and I, if we had a desire at all, wanted to believe that the whole thing was a hoax. For some reason we couldn't convince ourselves it was all as simple as the Major put it. As we left the dump, both Smithy and I seemed to be trying hard to convince Major Sander that we believed him. We had told him our stories separately. If he had thoroughly understood what we had told him, and thought that either one of us had an ounce of intelligence, he would have known that he had not completely convinced us of anything. It seemed unfair to judge Major Sander. Evidently Captain Smith invited him to come to town and give us his opinion. That is what I assumed, and I certainly didn't want to say anything that would seem critical of Major Sander's attempt to clear up the mystery. Major Sander drove us back to the hotel where he bade us goodbye, once again assuring us that within a couple of weeks we would be told the outcome of the characters involved in the investigation as well as what really caused the crash of the B-25. We thanked him. Even though it was a relief to have everything in military hands at last, we were still left wondering. As Smithy and I walked up the stairs, I was thinking that it was odd how Major Sander knew just the right side road to take out at the smelter and how he stopped only where there were pieces of slag that closely resembled the pieces of stuff we had. There were dumps all around, and yet he proceeded into the smelter grounds quite a long way and made a little turn before stopping and letting us out. I thought that he must have been there before. I wished we had hidden a few of the fragments. It would have been interesting to have had them chemically analyzed by a chemist who didn't know where they had come from. If we had been alert, this would have been done easily, we well as taking a few of the smelter fragments and having them analyzed and then comparing the two. Again, I rightly thought, why should I be suspicious of military intelligence not giving us the right dope? After all, like all policemen to some extent, they are supported by the taxpayers of the country, which included Captain Smith and myself, and I thought that the personnel had been properly trained to exercise their talents for the protection and benefit of all of us. It was a pleasant thought to take home with us. I packed my suitcase and we checked out of the Hotel Winthrop with a sigh of relief. I intended to go directly to Barry's airport. However, as we got into Captain Smith's car, I thought of Harold Dahl. He had seemed too sincere, and even though we couldn't figure it all out, we should at least say goodbye. Captain Smith thought it would be nice to see Harold and say goodbye too. Harold had mentioned he was going to be working all day on some book work at his secretary's house. We decided to take a quick run out there. I had taken special note of the location the night I rode out there with Harold, and it was only a 10-minute ride. I had Smithy take exactly the same route, and we arrived at the little white house on the corner. As we pulled up to the curb, I could see that the house was empty. I exclaimed to myself, "No, it can't be." I knew Captain Smith saw that I had suddenly become upset. In every respect, that house was the same house, located in the same place, where I had been the first night I met Harold Dahl. I got out of the car and walked up to the house, just as I had done that first night. I was completely baffled. As I stepped up on the porch, my weight caused the same squeak. The screen door was ajar. There were cobwebs extended from the main entrance door to the screen. There was the frosted glass window, exactly as I recalled it. I opened the screen, and there was the doorknob and all the other aspects of the door as I remembered it, exactly as I had seen it four nights before. Speaking of cold chills, I felt like someone had poured a whole bucket of ice water down my neck. I could not believe it. The house looked completely deserted and as if it had not been lived in for at least 3 months. I rushed around to the side of the house where I had noticed the radio aerial. Sure enough, there was the aerial, made out of 2 2x2s with the aerial wire leading in the side of the window. I had never heard of anything like this except in dreams. I was panicky. I raced around the side of the house and peered in the window. The rooms were all the same as I remembered, even to the kitchen nook and the color of the paint on the inside. I returned to the front door. I'd tried it. It was locked. I remembered that doorknob so well. When Harold Dahl, four nights before, had motioned me to go in, I had taken hold of the doorknob. This time I took hold of the doorknob the same way. It felt exactly the same in my hand. The screen door and the main door were hinged exactly as before. I turned around and stood on the walk, mumbling to myself, "Incredible. Absolutely incredible." I was really beginning to doubt my sanity. Suddenly the thought flashed into my mind, "I've just gotten the streets mixed up. I must have the streets mixed up. This must have a home that was built at the same time by the same contractor, and I'm just on the wrong street or at the wrong address." Captain Smith had gotten out of his car and was standing looking at me and looking at the house. If I was mistaken, T was one which looked just like this one. I wondered what a vacant house was doing in Tacoma. I had heard how acute the housing shortage was and that every available house was occupied with long waiting lists of families trying to find some place to live. This house looked like it has been vacant for months. There wasn't a stick of furniture inside, just dust, dirt, and cobwebs everywhere. I jumped back into Captain Smith's car and asked him to go back to the avenue so I could retrace myself. We did, and still came to the same house. I had him race up and down all the streets in the close vicinity. There wasn't another house within blocks and blocks that even resembled this one. I finally gave up looking. I wanted to get in my plane and fly home. As we drove away, I told Smithy my utter confusion. He just stared down the road, not saying a thing. Maybe he thought I was kind of buggy, I don't know. As we pulled up at Barry's airport, I suggested that he and I both inspect my airplane very carefully. He helped me inspect my ship from its nose to its tail. It appeared sound and airworthy. This house thing kept racing through my mind. I knew that on the coast cobwebs form very fast. But heavens, I couldn't figure how cobwebs in the amounts that were in and around that house could form in a few days' time. Even if Dahl's secretary had moved the same night I was there, it wasn't time enough. I tried to chalk it all up to mistaken directions and thought that at some later date I would get in touch with Harold Dahl and ask him about it. I have since tried to phone Harold Dahl on many occasions and have been unable to locate him. Less than a month after all this occurred, I attempted to call him and the operator told me they had no H. A. Dahl in their phone books. I don't see how this could be possible. I had seen his name in the phone book and had called him myself. I was quite sure that new books hadn't come out within this month and decided that the long-distance operator I talked to when I attempted my call was mistaken. I had had enough of playing investigator and the quicker I forgot about it, I told myself, the better off I would be. This wasn't the solution of this case, however, as I well know now. Today it is still a big mystery as to what actually took place in Tacoma, as it was on August 3, 1947. I started my airplane, warmed it up good, checked both my magnetos at full throttle, checked my gas lines, fuel valves and so on. Everything seemed to be in perfect order. Although it was rather late in the day, it was only about a 4-hour flight to Boise. When I got the weather sequence on my radio, I knew I would have a 20 to 30 miles per hour tailwind at the higher altitudes. I was anxious to get going. I shoved the throttle clear to the instrument panel and took off, feeling a little unsteady about everything but glad I was going home at last. As I circled the airport, I could still see Captain Smith looking up at me. I headed for home. I climbed to an altitude of about 8,000 feet. I felt a lot better after crossing the Cascades and started to let down over the Columbia River with the intention of landing at Pendleton, Oregon to get gasoline. Everything was running smoothly. I landed at Pendleton and the boys that gassed up my airplane. I got out of the cockpit to stretch my legs but stayed close to my plane. I signed my credit slip and with a full gas tank was ready to take off again for home. I wasn't tarrying as the hours of daylight were numbered. I had navigation lights but I didn't have a battery in my ship to operate them, so had to make it home before dark. I recall flipping my controls to indicate to the tower operator I was going to take off. The tower operator knew me and knew I had a receiver. He always came over the receiver to me if for some reason I should hold. Everything seemed fine. My plane was running well. Again I shoved the throttle clear to the stop. My engine roared and I was off the ground. I reached an altitude which I would judge was around 50 feet. My engine stopped cold. It was as if every piston had frozen solid. It never even gave a dying bark. To take off and have an engine stop at that low altitude is probably the most dangerous thing that can happen in an airplane. You don't have enough speed to sustain you for a normal landing in most craft. Your only choice for putting her down is straight ahead, with no power and little or no lift from the surfaces of your wings. Instinctively I dove the plane straight at the ground until I must have been within 10 feet of the runway, then came back on the stick as fast as I dared in an attempt to level off without causing an abrupt stall. My little airplane came though. I was sinking fast, but I set it down on all three points. The shock was pretty hard. My left landing gear was badly bent and my left spar was broken in two. At the moment I didn't know what had happened. Though the engine had frozen, I was unhurt. I jumped out of the cockpit, ran around to the front of the plane and turned the propeller. It was loose and easy. People came running out to see what was the matter. I was curious to see if my engine would start again. I scooted around the wing and back into the cockpit. There I discovered what had caused my engine to stop. Until this is written, I have kept this secret to myself. My fuel valve was shut off. I knew instantly there was only one person who could have shut that fuel valve off, and that was myself. I turned the fuel valve back on. One of the fellows swung the propeller. My engine started immediately and ran smoothly. I taxied my plane rather limpingly into the hangar. I was scared stiff. I didn't tell anyone what had happened for the simple reason that no one would believe me. The realization that my thought or mind in some peculiar way was being controlled or dictated to or that it could have caused this to happen would seem perfectly preposterous to anyone who had no experienced what I had just experienced. I was in no respect accustomed to turning my fuel valve off. I only did so when my plane was either leaking gas through the carburetor float or when I put it away in storage. I elected not to say anything to anyone until I had some logical reason within my mind to explain why I could do such a ridiculous thing. The care and precautions I had always exercised before taking off and which had become an established habit for me for over 3 years had somehow failed. I had to have time to think this out and I knew it had to be done by myself. Chapter 6. Project Saucer Report. On April 27, 1949, the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio released a report of its flying saucer investigations, popularly termed Project Saucer, to date. The following is a digest of this report. On Tuesday, June 24, 1947, a Boise, Idaho, businessman named Kenneth Arnold looked from his private plane and spotted a chain of 9 saucer-like objects playing tag with the jagged peaks of Washington's Mr. Rainier at what he described as a fantastic speed. Arnold's report set off a veritable celestial chain reaction. Within a few days, the fabulous flying saucers had spun into the national spotlight. Observers reporting sighting flying chromium hubcaps, flying dimes, flying teardrops, flying gas lights, flying ice cream cones, and flying pie plates. But to military intelligence, this sky potpourri came under a single heading, that of unidentified aerial phenomena. Exhaustive investigations of each reported sighting were launched. And Project Saucer was born. Now, almost 2 years later, Project Saucer is neither gone nor forgotten so far as the U.S. Air Force's Air Materiel Command at Wright Field is concerned. Official birthday for Saucer was January 22, 1948. since then. The command's Technical Intelligence Division, charged with the collection, investigation and interpretation of data relative to unidentified flying objects, has looked into more than 240 domestic and 30 foreign incidents. With assistance from several other government and private agencies, and with the entire facilities of the Wright Field Laboratories at their disposal, Project Saucer personnel have come up with identification of about 30% of the sightings studied thus far as conventional aerial objects. It is expected that further probing of incidents in relation to weather balloon locations, etc., will provide commonplace answers to at least an equal number of the sky riddles. Answers have been, and will be, drawn from factors such as guided missile research activity, weather and other atmospheric sounding balloons, astronomical phenomena, commercial and military aircraft flights, flights of migratory birds, shots from flare guns, practical jokers, victims of optical illusion, the phenomena of mass hallucination, and so forth. But to date there are still question marks in the saucer story. Although occasional sightings of strange aerial objects were reported as far back as January of 1947, it was the Mount Rainier incident that touched off the saucer sensation late the following June. Kenneth Arnold, representative of a fire control equipment firm in Boise, Idaho, was en route from Chehalis, Washington, to Yakima, Washington, on June 24 in a privately owned plane when he saw the reflection of a bright flash on his wing. Arnold said he looked around and observed a chain of 9 peculiar aircraft approaching Mount Rainier. I could see their outline quite plainly against the snow as they approached the mountain, he reported. They flew very close to the mountain tops, directly south to southeast down the hog's back of the range, flying like geese in a diagonal chain-like line as if they were linked together. Arnold observed that the objects seemed smaller than a DC-4 on his left, but he judged their wingspan to be as wide as the furthest engines on either side of the DC-4's fuselage. They were approximately 20 or 25 miles away, and I couldn't see a tail on them, he declared. I watched for about 3 minutes. A chain of saucer-like things at least 5 miles long, swerving in and out of the high mountain peaks. They were flat like a pie pan and so shiny they reflected the sun like a mirror. I never saw anything so fast, he told investigators. Today, no one knows just what Arnold did see on Mount Rainier, but the objects have been judged to be of non-astronomical origin according to an interim report submitted recently on Project Saucer by Professor Joseph A. Harnick, Ohio State University astrophysicist and head of their OSU Observatory. Dr. Harnick is working under contract with AMC on an independent investigation of saucer incidents to determine what percentage may definitely be attributed to astronomical phenomena. In his review of the Arnold incident, however, Dr. Harnick has come up with what he terms certain inconsistencies in Arnold's estimates of size, speed and performance of his flying saucers. It appears probable, Harnick reports, that whatever objects were observed were traveling at subsonic speeds and may therefore have been some sort of known aircraft. In the days that followed Arnold's observation, the disc reports began to snowball. At Muroc, California, a group of Air Force officers reported spotting spherical objects of a disc-like shape whirling through the sky at a speed in excess of 300 miles per hour. In Portland, or, several policemen told investigators they saw a group of discs that wobbled, disappeared and reappeared several times. They were described as resembling shiny chromium hubcaps. These objects were not of astronomical, stars, planets, meteors, etc., origin, according to Dr. Harnick's report. Regarding the Portland incident, he stated there is nothing whatever in this incident to suggest that the objects observed were of astronomical origin. The maneuvers of the objects and the relatively long time they were in sight definitely preclude their being astronomical. Only a few days after Arnold's sighting, a disc was reported seen over his hometown of Boise, a half circle in shape, clinging to a cloud and just as bright and silvery looking as a mirror caught in the rays of the sun. Early in August, 1947, two pilots for a Bethel, Alabama, flying service told investigators they spotted a huge black object bigger than a C-54 silhouetted against the brilliant evening sky.